Hello and welcome to Tickets, a podcast series exploring the future of live experiences. Each episode, we take you behind the scenes with the visionaries, producers and operators delivering some of the most vital and innovative experiences around. From Broadway theatre to international boxing, virtual reality to retail. Tickets aims to join the dots between disciplines, share knowledge and new ideas, and better understand what goes into bringing these experiences to life. My name's Howard Gray. I'm the founder of H Bureau, a specialist consultancy practice helping media, entertainment and experience companies grow. On the guest list today is Mia Trams, Editorial Director of Enterprise and Immersive Experiences at Time Magazine. Following a degree in visual arts at Columbia University, Mia began her career as a photo editor before branching out into VR through her role running Time's Life VR initiative. In this conversation, Mia talks about how she tackles telling compelling VR stories across over 30 brands, what it's like to run a startup within a large organization, the four levels of VR immersion, and reveals a life-changing night in the company of Gwen Stefani and Weezer. Enjoy.
So Life VR is what was formerly Time Inc. and currently Meredith Corporation's company-wide VR and AR initiative, which means it's both an umbrella brand for all of the immersive content that all of our brands do, from Time to Sports Illustrated to Travel and Leisure, People, Entertainment Weekly, the list goes on and on and on. As well as, kind of the hub of our business and go-to-market strategy for both of those technologies. And I am Time's Editorial Director of Enterprise and Immersive Experiences. I was formerly Managing Editor of Life VR and launched the brand for Time Inc. in 2016.
Can you just jump into your new role versus your old one? What's been the difference between the two? What are you working on now versus what you were working on before?
Yes. So for Life VR, I was working across all of our brands, developing and producing VR and AR experiences for each of them, as well as working closely with our business development and sales and marketing teams on making those things make money. Currently with Time, I'm leading all of our enterprise projects. I'm doing a bit of entrepreneurial work, working on new revenue streams for the brand, and I'll continue to do work in immersive storytelling. So I'm kind of wearing a bunch of hats.
So what was the catalyst for the company thinking that now was the, or that point was the time to start investing in VR more heavily? What was the catalyst for that?
So Chris Hersick, who has had many roles at this company, formerly creative director of Sports Illustrated, most recently creative content officer for The Foundry, which is our branded content wing. He has a good friend that works at HTC, and he saw the Vive headset and immediately said, we need to be in this space. So he kind of joined forces with the head of our video studio, Ian Orifice, Mike Beck, who was leading our branded video content at that time, and Rob Duffy, who was at the time our head of mobile apps. And they basically said, we need to solve for distribution if we're going to be in this space. It's really hard to get people in headsets. It's really hard to, publish across all the different platforms that exist. Let's create one umbrella brand that all of our content fits with under, whether it's People, Travel and Leisure, Time, et cetera. And the hope was that if you landed on that platform, which is now the Life VR app, that you would, go there to find something that you had seen from People, but maybe you'd be interested in something else that's there from Travel and Leisure. So they sort of launched that effort in earnest early 2016. They approached a bunch of the brand's editorial teams about ideas for VR for that year. And I had already been interested in that technology and doing my own recon for over a year at that point. And I came back to them with a list of 10 pages of ideas that I wanted to produce. And they said, oh my God, do you want to just run this thing? So I did.
Cool. And how did your own interest in VR start? How long, you said you were working on some ideas for a year before. Were you into VR way, way before that? Or was it around that time, a year before the department launched?
So I was hired at Time as a freelance breaking news photo editor on the website in 2013 and was working, digitally from the get-go. And in 2014, I found out that Fabien Cousteau, who's the grandson of Jacques Cousteau, was doing a 31-day underwater mission. And that's one day longer than the longest mission that Jacques ever did. And he was doing it on this crazy underwater science lab called Aquarius that's off the Florida Keys. It truly just looks like something out of a Jules Verne novel. It's covered in coral. Fish live on it. You know, it looks like a submarine that's kind of strapped to the ocean floor. And I started pitching along with Jonathan Woods, who was my boss and head of Time.com Photo at the time, a project to do Time's first underwater 360 video and go on a dive with Fabien around Aquarius. So we finally got it approved. And then I was basically like, oh, my God, I have no idea how to do this. So, you know, it took a few months, but we basically, you know, found the only pressure-tested underwater rig that was on the market at that time. It's not that long ago, but the production technology has really, you know, improved leaps and bounds since then. We had to kind of jerry-rig a video player that could handle 360 video. And pretty much from that point forward, I was hooked on immersive storytelling and was looking into if we were to produce proper VR for Time, what would that look like?
Just to digress very slightly with the technology, has the quality of the production technology gone up, the costs come down, or a bit of both in the last couple of years?
So I think it's important to distinguish between 360 video and you know, experiences that are built in a game engine and that are essentially a piece of software. When it comes to 360 video, even just on the commercial level, there's been a huge improvement in the cameras that are available, both in, you know, the quality of the footage that they capture, the ease of post-production once you get that footage, and the price point. All of that's, you know, really improved in the last couple of years, and there's some great solutions on the market. When it comes to, you know, proper VR, as I like to call it, where you're building a piece of software and most likely you're building, you know, a three-dimensional world in CGI or using photogrammetry or, you know, volumetric capture or combination of all of those things. When I first started researching that type of VR for Time in 2014, I would sort of cold call production companies and they'd be like, oh yeah, we could do that for you for $2 million. And I was like, there's no way this old media company is going to spend $2 million on VR. But now, you know, I think there's so many amazing production studios in the mix that, you know, the price points have come down. The quality of the work has gone up. Our understanding of how to tell stories in that space has, you know, really developed. So it's a really rich ecosystem right now.
So if we go back, you mentioned that you were in the photo editor before you got into the VR space. If we go back before that, I know you were at Columbia doing visual arts. So what did you learn from doing a visual arts degree? I guess there wasn't much VR on the syllabus. I'm going back then. No. It wasn't really a thing. What did you learn from doing a visual arts degree that you took into your photo editing role here at Time and then into VR? What were the things that really came out from that time?
So I think when I was at Columbia University, the class that really continues to have an effect on me now was a sculpture class that I took with this artist named Debo Eilers. And I was mainly focused on photography. I studied under Tom Roma, you know, which was mainly learning black and white street photography, working in film, you know, all of these really meditative, slow processes. But I took this sculpture class, and Debo is a very performative artist. And he was asked by PS1 to do an installation in their basement. And he basically came to our sculpture class and said, hey, I get to do this installation at PS1. All of you can contribute. Let's just make a huge sculpture party, basically. And I created this really weird installation that was kind of a giant abstract kind of cage made out of 2x4s. That had very sharp pointy ends. So it looked like this cage was kind of stabbing into the floor. And in the middle of it, if you were laying underneath, I put kind of above you a reflective kind of mirror piece that was, you know, shaped a certain way. So, you know, it was kind of like a funhouse mirror that if you were laying underneath a sculpture, you could see yourself in. And as part of the installation, I got a headphone splitter And I would ask people to lay down underneath this stabbing sculpture with me and listen to love songs and hold my hand.
Did a lot of people say yes to this?
A lot of people did say yes to this. I also had a flashlight, so I was kind of making these, you know, dreamy reflections off of this mirror that was above us. And then there was just chaos happening all around us. But it was this sort of like more peaceful bubble where you could come hold my hand with this very threatening sculpture looming over you. And, you know, the reason that I connect the dots between what I'm doing now and what that was is I think I've always wanted to give people an experience and kind of like immerse them in something. That's sort of how my brain works when it comes to storytelling. It's not very linear. It's very much like, how do I envelope you in, you know, a world or a feeling or a emotion? So, you know, it wasn't what I was focused on there, but it certainly seems to have tapped into a piece of my brain that I use a lot now.
So that was a show at MoMA PS1?
Yes.
Here in New York, which is Long Island City, right?
Yes,
which has, I suppose, is that the more kind of experimental arm of MoMA's?
Yeah. Very experimental.
Hence the funhouse mirror and the cage.
Yes, exactly.
So if we fast forward back to kind of today, in the last couple of years, you worked on a bunch of different projects across the life or the time spectrum. We'll get into the different brands in a second, but working across everything from like the solar eclipse to Everest to film studio projects, what have you noticed have been the commonalities between them, and how do you approach these kind of projects in VR rather than if it was a brief for print or for film, or more like you were saying, it's a more immersive format rather than more linear? How have you gone about approaching those projects that are so diverse?
So for each brand, it's different. You know, the way that I approach VR for People versus Sports Illustrated versus Time versus Travel and Leisure, they're all, you know, very different and sort of isolated unto themselves. I think, you know, the first and most important thing that I use as, you know, kind of a guiding light for any of these brands is the fact that they do have a legacy. And there are a lot of people out in the world that already have an emotional connection to, you know, what that brand has been for many years. And I really wanted to honor what that was. And I've tried to put myself in the shoes of, you know, fans of those brands and say, if I were a person who didn't work here but had read Time Magazine or had read People or had read Sports Illustrated for years and years and years, maybe, and grew up with it, what would I want that brand's VR programming to look like? What would I expect to come from, you know, these brands that I've loved for so long? So that's always the guiding principle, kind of honor, you know, the emotional connection that people already have. I think the next piece is maintaining a certain level of ambition. So as we know, you know, the consumer adoption hurdles for VR are quite high. Not only do you have to sort of still explain to consumers what this is, you also then have to convince them to probably download an app and then find a headset or buy a headset to watch the content in. And then, you know, they're watching it by themselves, probably at home, maybe at their office for, you know, 3 to 5 to 10 minutes. It's a lot to ask of a consumer. So what I've tried to do is pick or develop projects that if you came across them in your Facebook feed, you would say, oh my God, I have to see that. I have to see what it's like to get to the top of Everest. I have to see what it's like to time travel back to the 1940s and experience the attack on Pearl Harbor. I have to try, you know, this Star Wars experience that, you know, People has distributed with Disney. So, you know, we keep the bar very high, really, because, you know, it has to be compelling. It has to compel a viewer to jump through all the hoops they need to see it.
So I believe a couple of your projects have been nominated for Emmy Awards. Am I right in thinking
yes,
that?
Yes, yes.
Can you just briefly talk us through those projects specifically and maybe their timeline and how they came to be?
Absolutely. So yes, this was very exciting. We were nominated for 2 Sports Emmy Awards. One was for a project that we helped to distribute and also add an AR component to, which was called Take Every Wave. And it's a VR companion piece to a documentary about the iconic surfer Laird Hamilton. And it was distributed through Life VR with Sports Illustrated. It was produced by a really amazing company that we've partnered with a lot named Riot, directed by a dear friend of mine and very talented VR brain, Elijah Allen Blitz, and you get to surf the longest wave in the world with Laird. The second project has been one of the biggest labor of loves for me. it's called Capturing Everest. It's our Everest series. It was, when we published it, the first VR docuseries to capture a bottom-to-top climb of the tallest peak in the world. You follow three climbers. One is Jeff Glassbrenner, who with our climb became the first American amputee to summit. He has one leg, and his climbing leg is very cool. It's made by NASA. He's a, you know, triathlete. He's an Ironman. He's just an incredible human in so many ways. Our other climber is Lisa White. Initially, she was planning only to climb to base camp. And while she was training for that climb, she received a breast cancer diagnosis. And because she is who she is, she decided because of that diagnosis that she would start training to climb to the top of Everest. So while she was training to climb, she was receiving chemotherapy. She had a double mastectomy, and then she quit her job and sold her house and flew to Nepal to start her climb. She's incredible. So the series is in four parts. It's episodic. Each part deals with either, you know, preparing for the climb or different stages of the climb. We have, you know, everything from orienting yourself in base camp, which is itself kind of its own mini city, to the most dangerous part of one of the routes called the Khumbu Icefall, to, you know, actually reaching the peak at the end. And we distributed it as a VR four-part series across all of Life VR's channels. It was also a cover story for Sports Illustrated. It was our first AR activated issue in the company with SI. And then we also had a 360 video hub on SI.com. So truly multi-platform. We blew out every, you know, possible medium that we could to both publish and support the project. And now we're nominated for an Emmy for digital innovation.
So you mentioned earlier that you're working with Time Magazine, Sports Illustrated, People. There's about is about 30 brands in total across the company thereabouts.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to all of them yet, but they're in the mix. Yeah.
So how do you figure out which stories are worth telling in VR, which are going to work, which could work, which ones maybe you should pass on? How, across a huge company with loads of different people involved, and maybe some people who haven't experienced or worked in this medium before, is a lot of your work around educating people and outreach to help them understand the medium and what they can and can't do?
Absolutely. So when I first took on the role, there was an incredible amount of teaching involved. I really just had to tell people what this was, how to think about it for their brand, give them a range of options, but then also say to them, you know your brand and your audience better than I ever will. So let me give you the tools to think about this, and we'll work on it together and develop your brand strategy together. I think, you know, something that we had to sift through a lot and that I think would apply to anyone working in VR is if it would be better as a two-dimensional video or as a photograph or as a written piece, just like anything, you know, don't do it in VR. It's so hard to get people in the headset. It's so much more complex of a production process. I think that if it works better in another medium, one, people likely aren't going to watch it or enjoy it, and two, the story would be better serviced through something more traditional. I think another really important piece of the puzzle for anyone who's considering working in VR is just watching as much as they can. I am constantly watching, you know, as many things as I can get my hands on, new formats, new production techniques, how they're being applied. I'm constantly meeting with companies that do all facets of post-production, production, you know, everything in between. Keeping up on, you know, the latest developments in capture technology, you know, distribution, all of that. It's such a quickly evolving market. I think you really have to be educated to make smart decisions for your company.
So if we extend that out a little bit towards brands and agencies, when you started out as effectively as a startup within a big corporation, we'll get into that in a bit, the challenges of running a startup within a big company. Presumably you were going out to market, you were going and talking to brands and agencies and explaining what you were doing, why it was interesting. What were those first days like, and what did you learn from your first meetings and pitching this and getting people to buy into it? And what advice would you have for a small startup, or maybe a startup within a big company or a growing company, of how they should interact with brands and agencies, particularly when they have something that's unknown, innovative, different, and maybe a little bit unproven and untested?
I think that the number one thing I would suggest is don't tell people, show people. So anytime we were going to have a meeting with any of the clients or agencies that our company works with, I would sort of insist that there be 30 minutes to an hour, depending on how much time they could afford, for VR demos. And I would show them not necessarily just projects that I had produced, but what I thought was the best of the best in, you know, all the different formats, from 360 in a Gear headset to Tilt Brush in a Vive, so that the client really had an understanding of the landscape that we were going to be talking about within for them, and what the options are, because there are a lot of options in terms of VR production. You know, you can work across many different formats. So I tried to give any clients or agencies we were working with a solid foundational knowledge from which we could have a conversation about what would make sense for them. I had to do the same thing with all of our sales reps internally. I had to do the same thing with all of our editorial teams. So a good part of the first year, and even, you know, currently of my job, is education and showing people and then making sure that they have a working understanding of the technology.
For someone listening who's maybe not that familiar with particularly the technologies involved, you touched on Tilt Brush and Vive and so on. What are some of the differences between the headsets and other technologies that people are using, either from a consumer or a professional point of view, and kind of what's your preferred toolkit for someone looking to get involved, maybe as a media brand or as a consumer?
So we generally talk about four levels of immersion. At the kind of bottom baseline, you have 360 video. So this is just spherical video that's shot with, you know, an Insta Pro camera or a GoPro Omni Rig or even a Ricoh Theta, which is kind of the point and shoot version of a 360 camera. And that's video that you can distribute in a 360 video player on your own website. You can now distribute through Facebook 360, YouTube 360, Vimeo has 360 capabilities. It gets distributed almost the same as 2D video does now, and consumers can watch it on a computer or on their phone, or even some smart TVs now support 360 video. The next level up is using a smartphone cardboard app. So Cardboard is, you know, a technology that Google developed. It literally works with a VR headset that's made out of cardboard. They look sort of like the magic viewers that we had back in the day as kids. And you can basically develop an application that plays back 360 video or nonlinear experiences that viewers can use magic window style with their phone and kind of just, you know, look around the sphere with, you know, the phone without the headset. Or they can find a cardboard headset, which generally costs about $10, to view it in a more immersive way. The next step up from that, I would say, is something like a Gear headset. Samsung makes the Gear in partnership with Oculus. And you're using a Samsung Android phone. There's different versions of this that work with other phones, but you're getting a slightly higher quality experience than Cardboard can give you. And it, you know, runs off of a platform like Samsung VR, which we also published to. Top of the line when you're talking about consumer experiences are PC-based headsets. This is your Oculus Rift, your HTC Vive. Now Windows has, or Microsoft rather, has a line of partner headsets for Windows XR. There's, you know, a range of headsets that run off of a PC and have a higher, you know, computing power behind them because of that. The benefit of these headsets is that you can create experiences that are essentially pieces of software. They are in many ways like video games. They're also sort of like Pixar films. And you can give your viewer a sense of having free will and the ability to affect what they're experiencing. It's the closest thing to true VR if, you know, we're working with the definition of VR being a virtual environment built in a computer and viewed in a head-mounted display. And that's the, you know, it's both the top of the line in terms of a consumer-grade experience. It's also the most expensive way in for a consumer to experience what you've made. So you have bottom, you know, cheapest, most democratic, but lowest quality, and at the top, most expensive, but best quality, and honestly, I think most interesting applications of the media's storytelling device.
So there's a few things in there I wanted to unpack a little bit. As you were talking, it made me think about the Steven Soderbergh immersive TV show Mosaic, which came out recently, which I found really fascinating because I've always found the idea of the interactive user-controlled storytelling really interesting. I used to read those Choose Your Own Adventure books when I was a kid and all that kind of
those
thing.
Were great.
Showing what a geek I am. how do you think VR is going to pan out? The industry, maybe more broadly, is going to pan out over the next couple of years, because you touched on briefly that the hardware challenge is still there. Maybe the access to content is a challenge too. I'm really interested to get your thoughts on that, and also whether you think that that kind of interactive, user-controlled storytelling is going to become more prevalent at the top end, or whether it will start seeping down into more mass market as well. I'd love to get your take on where you think the all of those strands are going to go in maybe the next couple of years or so.
So I find it hard to predict where this is all headed, but I do have my own thoughts and recommendations on creating a strategy that is forward-looking. So when we've created experiences for the Vive or Oculus headset, which are the ones that I really prefer to create, the ones where you really are leveraging the power of a powerful PC and you have these higher quality headsets, I try to think about what are the public locations that I could install this in that add to the context of the experience and that also have a built-in interested viewership. So, for example, one of the experiences that we produced early on is called Remembering Pearl Harbor. It was for the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. We created it. It kind of came from the mind of Times history editor Lily Rothman. I worked in collaboration with her, Liz Ronk, who was formerly the photo editor of Life, and a few other outside organizations to create this experience that takes you back to that moment in time. Both on the home front and then actually on the harbor itself to see, you know, the aftermath of the destruction. It's told through the eyes of Lieutenant Jim Downing, who was one of the oldest living survivors of the attack at the time that we recorded it. He was 103. He actually just passed this year at 104. Really, really amazing, wonderful person. And we knew going into this that there would be an audience of history buffs, there would be an audience of students, and there would be an audience of veterans that would be interested in seeing this. Most of those people not only would not have access to a Vive headset, which is the headset that we built it for, but they also wouldn't necessarily seek that out on their own. But they would, perhaps around the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, be at a museum exhibition, where they are interested to relive some of this stuff, learn about some of this history, interact with media that gives them more than maybe they'd get, you know, at home looking at their computer. So we tried to partner with museums that were programming around the anniversary and have our experience installed there as part of what they were offering to the public. I think it was a really interesting kind of first step into that space for us. It's kind of a new space in terms of how museums are thinking about incorporating VR into their existing programming. I think there's a lot to work out there, but it was important for us to kind of be one of the first to help with that experimentation and be a guinea pig in a certain way, learn from it, and then take some of those learnings back into new projects that we're developing, really with the intention of putting them back out into the public space instead of expecting people to watch them at home.
Do you think that the same may happen in industries like retail and sports and entertainment, where you'll be putting experiences into a place where people are, there's already a captive audience, so whether it's a sports stadium or a retail store as well as a museum? Do you think that will happen more in the next year or two before the consumer side grows significantly?
So when it comes to retail and sports, I think that AR probably has a better chance in those spaces. I know that there's certain sports leagues that are already looking at integrating AR into your stadium experience. But when it comes to VR, I think two companies really to keep an eye on are Dreamscape and The Void. Dreamscape, one of their investors is Westfield Malls. They're going to start opening Dreamscape locations in certain malls domestically. And then The Void, you know, is sort of the pioneer of this location-based format. They create shared experiences that you can do with, you know, a handful of your friends. They are programmed to be installed in large spaces. So, you know, for example, they created an experience, a Ghostbusters experience that's at Madame Tussauds here in New York City in Times Square. And you go with, you know, four of your closest friends, and you can see each other as avatars within this virtual world that they put you in. And you are on a floor of Madame Tussauds running around in a virtual environment of New York City fighting ghosts together. It's super fun. It's much more like a theme park ride than, you know, a film or something like that. But I think in terms of consumer adoption of VR, I think that is one of the most likely and plausible paths forward for generating revenue.
My mum is in town this week, so I don't know whether she'll be up for fun.
You should definitely take her.
I think she'd rather just go to the Met and then have a coffee, probably.
A little more chill.
Yeah, mum, if you're listening, we'll see. I'll let you know if we end up doing it. I think it's unlikely, but it does sound amazing.
It's super fun. I've done it twice.
So let's change lanes just a little bit. I wanted to ask you about identifying talent, because I think your path from your visual arts background in Columbia and then through sculpture and into photo and then into VR is really interesting. How do you identify, or how would you go about identifying new talent to either collaborate with or work with you in the team, or just people who are out there in this space? Because obviously, it's quite nascent still. It's still VR kind of V2.0, because there was the first wave 15, 20 years ago, but this particular new wave is still relatively new. Do you think, though, that talent is going to be VR native, as it were, or do you look at people from adjacent disciplines and judge their abilities based on what they've done in other spaces? How do you go figuring out whether someone is going to be a really great partner or collaborator to work with?
So it sort of depends on the project that we're working on. I've had different people kind of cycle in and out of my team over the last 2 years. For certain periods of time, it's made sense to have someone working with me that's a bit more entrepreneurial, as we were talking about earlier. It is such a new space that, you know, for a while, what I needed was kind of a co-conspirator to wear as many hats as I was wearing. And I had a few different freelancers working with me over the months that could kind of fill a bunch of different roles, everything from, you know, helping to oversee some of the post-production and editing of experiences that we're working on, to helping me run demos in the lab and explaining how this technology works to people who don't understand it, to, uploading all of the content to the platforms that we needed to upload it to, and helping write the email newsletter and all that stuff. So in that particular case, having someone that had a really strong storytelling background, but that was also comfortable kind of functioning as an entrepreneur in a really scrappy way, helped me get a lot of things done. And, you know, by proxy, our brand get a lot of things done. At different points, it's been really important to have someone who has some experience shooting and editing 360 video. And, you know, I think it doesn't necessarily have to be that you're hiring someone who has experience in these technologies. If they're functioning as an executive producer or a producer or even a director, I think in those types of roles, what you want is someone who can think about what it feels like to be immersed in something. Perhaps someone who has a theater or dance background, because those people really think spatially. I think folks that come from experimental theater are unusually well suited to work in this medium. If you're talking about the actual production, It sort of depends on what format you're working in. If it's 360 video, you want someone who knows how to shoot and edit 360 video and has experience doing that. If you're building out, you know, a CGI experience that's running off of Unity or Unreal, which are game engines, you definitely want someone who has experience working with 3D graphics and with those programs, or perhaps someone who used to work in video games, because there are a lot of overlaps between video games and this more nonlinear version of the medium.
You're effectively running a startup, as we mentioned both before we started recording and earlier on in this conversation. What advice do you have for someone who's maybe in your shoes when they're within a big company and starting something new, or just a scrappy startup team who want to get out there in the world? What's your learnings been over the past two and a half years that you've been in this role?
You know, we have a joke that Life VR has all of the challenges of a startup and all the bureaucracy of a large corporation, which is certainly, it's just been the case for the last 2 years, but with a lot of support and, you know, kind of investment from this company in a bunch of different ways. I would say that, again, you know, really knowing your market is an important thing. I'm constantly reading about VR. I'm constantly meeting people that work in the industry, trying to understand what the borders and fringes of it are and what's coming down the pipe so that I can kind of strategize with a forward-looking gaze. I think that really understanding who you are trying to reach with this technology and storytelling is super, super important. I think understanding where you're going to distribute the content once it's made is more important than even the content that you're making itself. You know, it's very different to create a VR experience for at-home viewership versus viewership in a public space. There's very different things to take into consideration, and that's just something that we've learned kind of trialed by error. I think that understanding that, if your goal is to make VR for other companies, knowing that VR isn't actually a good solution for every situation, knowing what situations it is a good solution for, will help build trust with any clients that you have. I think trying to foist VR on people for things that don't really make sense is a great way to end a conversation early. I think you want them to know that you're thinking about it critically and applying it where it really will have value for their brand and their purposes. So those are some of the most important things that I've learned in the last couple of years.
So clearly you spend a lot of time in and around the space, both with your role here, but also, I guess, as an audience member. What are some of the most interesting or exciting or innovative uses of VR you've seen outside of your personal work?
So one of my favorite experiences I've ever seen is something that the BBC made. It's called The Turning Forest. It's a couple years old now. I saw it at the Tribeca Film Festival. I still wonder like why the BBC made this, but I think it's so wonderful. It's a nonlinear experience. It's all CGI, so it looks sort of like a Pixar movie. And you are a little kid, so you're very short in the experience. And, you know, that's one of the great things about VR. You can really play with scale and perspective. You're a little kid in this, you know, very beautiful cartoon forest. And you look up, the leaves are falling on you, everything's sort of like neon orange and pink. And then this giant kind of never-ending story looking monster walks up to you and puts his eyeball like right in front of your face. And then he puts his mouth right in front of your face and he opens his mouth and he has these very long kind of icicle looking teeth. And as you gaze at them, they play music. And I was like, this is wild, but it's just delightful. And then he, at a certain point, the forest floor melts under you and he swims underneath you and takes you off on this journey where you can look at things and have them play music. It's a really beautiful exercise in, the power of sound and audio as part of the storytelling of VR. I think what I loved about it is, there's been a lot of talk around VR creating empathy, especially in journalism, and all these very, you know, important but sort of sad, serious experiences coming out that for a while, I think, defined what media companies were looking to VR to do. And what I loved about that piece was VR is magical, and it can take you to magical places that are delightful. And, you know, it was an exercise in storytelling that tapped into the magic that the medium has.
It's called The Turning Forest.
The Turning Forest. Amazing. It's so cool.
That sounds great. On that note, I wanted to ask you about some of the stories you want to tell next. If you could choose, if you had the choice to tell any kind of stories, what would you like to get involved in next?
Yes. So there's kind of two tracks that I'm looking at. One is going deeper into the historical experience track, because I am working now for the Time brand instead of all of the brands. I think something that Time does really well is kind of puts a stamp of authority on experiences that have shaped our history. And again, if I think about what I would want as a Time reader, I'd want to see something like Remembering Pearl Harbor. I'd want to see the Gettysburg Address. I'd want to see the March on Washington, you know, these kind of formative American and international historical experiences. So that's one track I am exploring and, you know, working on actively. The other track is, since the beginning of working on Life VR and now VR and AR for Time, I've been really fascinated by the usefulness of VR as a tool. You know, before it was a consumer product, it was being used by NASA to train astronauts and the military, and it has been used in medicine for nearly 30 years. So one of the early experiences I produced was called Lumen, which is a relaxation experience. And we produced it with the help of Dr. Walter Greenleaf from Stanford, who's been working in medical VR for about 30 years. It's currently being implemented at the Stanford Children's Hospital as part of a program called Project Braveheart to help calm kids before and after heart surgery. And I think there's other versions of that I'd like to continue to explore in the next year, maybe more consumer facing than B2B. You know, how do we use VR to have a conversation about racism in this country? How do we use it to have a conversation around sexual assault and, you know, some of the issues that have been brought up by the Me Too movement that really need to be handled in a nuanced way? You know, I think there's a lot of applications for VR as something that can help teach people, help people practice certain skills, teach them skills that they didn't have in the first place. And, you know, I think that the Time brand in particular lends itself pretty well to VR in that format.
Yeah, I agree. I think the three things you mentioned were kind of the three I had in mind too, that healthcare, education, I guess the more social studies and anthropology side of it, I think are three super interesting areas.
Absolutely.
Just before we wrap, a couple of maybe more slightly practical questions. From a work perspective or a professional, maybe a more personal perspective, what are some of the most useful maybe habits, routines, or behavior changes that you've made in yourself in the last 12 months to make you more productive, more effective, more efficient? I know you said before it's an ongoing process, trial and error, ongoing process, just like for me. But what have been some of the things that you found have been working really well for you in your work?
I'm always trying to figure this out, just like anyone, I guess, who's working and trying to stay on top of their lives. I am a huge fan of Todoist. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I've heard of that, yeah.
It's great. I mean, anyone who's worked with me jokes about how much I love to-do lists and, you know, really thorough documentation. So I have Todoist on my computer and I have it on my phone and it's open all day long and I use it to kind of keep myself on task. And I have great satisfaction from checking off boxes as I get things done, and you get like, you know, a score for how much you get done every day. It really speaks to my competitive nature. Something else that I've just started doing, which I told you about earlier, is making breakfast for myself. So on Sundays now, I've been making fruit cups for the week because I was not eating breakfast. And as anyone will tell you, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. So I now pre-prepare my breakfast on Sundays and am just taking it with me on the subway to work. But I think, you know, there's also something really important about taking in what's around you. I spend a lot of time just reading about stuff that's not related to my job or related to projects that I'm working on, seeing as many movies as I can, going to, you know, events or, you know, things happening in the city that aren't related to what I'm doing but feed a creative and entrepreneurial part of myself. I even just sort of recurated who I follow on Instagram so that I'm getting a certain kind of information incoming when I look at that, which I do often throughout the day. You know, I think it's important to kind of tune yourself to the culture that's happening around you and the context that you're working within, if you're going to be a storyteller yourself, or, you know, an entrepreneur. I think you really have to kind of know what the pulse is. So I spend a lot of time making sure that I'm plugged into that, in addition to what's going on here at my office.
I am also a to-do list geek.
So good.
Massively. And I've started using Instagram again. I banned myself from it for about 2.5 years, and I'm back on.
Oh my gosh, welcome back.
I know, I'm back.
It's a happier space than some other social media platforms.
Yes, I agree. I'm not going to go any further than that on that topic. Lastly, I'd love to know your most memorable live experience personally, whether it's through work or just as a fan, whether it's in VR or in real life. What's something that comes to mind?
So there were two that came to mind, but one of them, the first concert I ever went to was No Doubt and Weezer.
Wow. I've got the Weezer Blue album at home.
Oh my God, it's so good.
I think it's still in London. I think I left it in the shipping. It didn't make it to New York.
Oh no. You gotta get that back.
Yeah, I gotta get that back.
It was awesome because I was 12 years old and obsessed with Gwen Stefani, and I had, you know, put on a bindi and had my hair, you know, in panda ears like hers, and I was wearing like cargo pants and a midriff, and I was 12, so it's like, you know, weird, but that's what one does in the 90s. And I went with two of my best friends and their mother. She was chaperoning us because we were little.
Where was this?
This was in, I think it was in Orange County.
Okay.
I grew up in Los Angeles, so it was in California. And I remember that, one, because Gwen Stefani stood up on a speaker and it was in the middle of I'm Just a Girl, and she screamed, F you, I'm a girl, and then had everybody in the audience scream it back at her. And I was 12, so I was like, I can't say that. But then I said it and it was really fun. It was also the first time that I ever smelled weed. I remember smelling it and looking at my friend's mom being like, what is that? And she's like, oh, that's marijuana. And I was like, oh, okay, I kind of understand what that is. But the other experience that I think of...
there was a lot going on that night. But
it was like an awakening. Yeah.
Right.
The other experience that immediately came to mind was when I was in, I don't know if it was middle school or high school, we used to have these silent auctions to help, you know, raise money for our school. And one of the things that was auctioned off one year was going to see a play with our choir teacher, who was this incredible woman. Her name is Tia Kano. I'm still in touch with her. She's doing amazing things with other choirs now. And she was kind of the coolest teacher at the school. So, you know, getting to go see a play with her was like a big deal. So I don't know if my parents bid on this or someone else's parents bid on it and then I got to go, but someone won it and I was the recipient of that winning in some form. And we got to go see Hedwig and the Angry Inch with her live. The first iteration of it with the original cast and, you know, the man who conceived of it and then played Hedwig. And I can't remember his name right now. It's killing me. But again, I was pretty young. I was definitely preteen, I would say. The concept of transvestites was a new one to me. And, you know, this play is about someone who gets his, you know, surgery botched and has an angry inch, as he calls it. So that was wild in a lot of ways. It was all, you know, like much more adult than I was prepared for. But the end of that play, there's a song where the lyrics are, put out your hands, and Hedwig is singing to the audience, put out your hands, put out your hands. it's really, he's asking like everybody to connect with each other. And he or she is on stage with this incredible wig on, this all sparkles all over her face, this incredible outfit. It totally makes sense that I love Drag Race now and all things that have to do with drag queens. But there was this light that they kind of shot from behind Hedwig. So it looked like he was standing in front of the sun or like an exploding star or something and just singing, "Put Out Your Hands." And I just remember completely giving into it, feeling, you know, that shiver go down my spine. And again, I think it's, there's something about immersing an audience in an emotion, something about immersing an audience in a feeling and then creating a connection with that, that I have tried to do with my work, you know, on time.com. I've really tried to do with my work with Life VR and what I will try to continue to do with Time.
So are we going to see a Hedwig VR experience?
Oh my
VR
God, it's so amazing. I should probably do that, shouldn't
I? You can steal that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Mia, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time.
It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for having me.
Join us next time for another edition of Tickets. You can subscribe via Apple Podcasts and Stitcher, or listen back through SoundCloud and Acast. Tickets is an HBRO production. Find out more at hbro.com.